and welcome to the Dr. Squeeze Show podcast, featuring all the best bits from my radio show this week. Remember, if you want to listen in live and hear all the music, which we have to cut out of this podcast for rights reasons, please go to thebear.live every Thursday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m. GMT. Thank you very much and enjoy this week's show.
Welcome to the show with your friend and mine. So tell me, Dr. Squee, who's it gonna be this time? We like to hear you talk, and we love to hear you listen. And if you are not subscribed, you won't know what you're missing. So welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. Welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. Welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. Headphones up. Here we go.
Hello there, this is David Osman from the Fire Sign Theater. Whenever I'm kind of wandering around the blogs trying to find something really interesting, I go to the bear and I ask the bear to show me the Dr. Squee Show. It's wonderful.
Hello and welcome to the Dr. Squee Show. I'm Dr. Squee and this is my show, and indeed it is wonderful. We've got a great one coming up for you. Later on, we've got Sarah Chowdhury, the Curry Queen, joining us. And if you haven't heard the name before, she is an excellent entrepreneur and chef who has appeared on the likes of BBC and Channel 4. And she's an independent businesswoman. And it's an amazing story. She is multiple award winning. It's wonderful. We had a great time chatting just a few days ago, and I'll bring you that interview tonight. And later on, we're going to be talking about WandaVision. Now, that TV show, if you haven't caught it yet, it is amazing, from the likes of Marvel. And it's just been such a wonderful show. It's coming to a close this week, and we thought it would be a good time to catch up on everything which has happened so far. I only had one interview this week, so I thought it was a good time to add a bit of chat and a bit more music to the show this week. So that's what I've been looking forward to doing. And we've also got the big question of the week, which is, in light of WandaVision coming to the end of its series, if you could get trapped in one TV show with one person, what TV show would it be and who would it be with? So where in WandaVision they get trapped in sitcoms, what TV shows would you pick? So we've got a few answers for you now. Marina Claire Ryan has put, what about One Family? All cheeky, but we'll allow it. I'd love to get stuck with the Addams Family, like they can adopt me. I feel like with them, it would be so much more, life would be so much more interesting. A mini adventure every day. Morticia could be supportive of every weird thing that I want to do and help me sew my cosplay outfits. And Gomez would teach me how to fence. Maybe a little archery, a little bit of archery, and throwing knives or axes, and maybe even how to dance. Sounds dangerous to me, but dancing with axes, why not? I would be best friends with Wednesday, sharing a love of macabre history, and I would introduce her to Seconds from Disaster and Air Crash Investigations, both excellent TV shows, of course. We got Richard Carpenter's put, bottom with Rick Mayall. Why? Because A, it's Rick fucking Mayall, and B, well, do I need a B when the A is so great? Of course you don't. You see, the thing is, I've left it open to interpretation. My thought was, like, which person would you choose to get stuck with? But you seem to have picked characters and celebrities and kind of all sorts, so it's been interesting. Got Charlotte Lucy has put, Blossom, I never grow out of my love for that show. Oh, Miami Bialik, back in the day, if I could even say that name. And she said she'd get stuck there with her dad, so she has picked someone personal. Kia Little has put, Doctor Who, which is also my answer to which TV series. It's in its entirety, so geez, you're going to be living for thousands of years in Doctor Who time, which would take, which is what he would also take to a deserted island, because then you're trapped in all of time and space. I like it. Awesome answer. John Shaw's put My So-Called Life, and Soshana Medney. And sorry for butchering your name there. She's put, ooh, good question. Sticking in the superhero theme, I would love to be stuck in Supergirl. Who knows, maybe I'd have superpowers and I could team up with Supergirl, The Flash, and I'd go with my boyfriend John. And I'm sure your boyfriend John would very much enjoy being there with Supergirl. I know I would. Just saying. We've got loads more answers to that, and we're going to be talking WandaVision later. But let's hear a couple of tunes, then we're going to be hearing from the curry queen, Sarah Chowdhury. So first of all, we're going to hear a couple of tunes. This is, in no particular order, I'm trying to remember which tunes we've got lined up. So of course, we've got Enter the Sandman by Metallica, followed by Real Big Fish and their version of Take On Me.
Hi, this is Bill Oberst Jr., and you're listening to the Dr. Squee Show here on The Bear. Stay tuned. Don't leave. Don't make me go all creepy on your ass.
My guest today is an Indian food expert. Her recipes and articles have featured in publications locally, nationally, and internationally, including the Financial Times, The Telegraph, The Independent, and various others. Forbes highlighted her as a disruptor in the Indian catering industry and titled her the Curry Queen. Another Forbes feature highlighted her as one of the world's foremost authorities in Indian food. She recently presented BBC's Inside Out program, which highlighted female chefs in the UK, which was translated and featured on BBC World News in 14 countries. In 2016, she took part in Channel 4's cookery show, where she had the pleasure of working alongside Prue Leith, CBE, Michael Caines, MBE, and Raymond Blanc. Please welcome to the Dr. Squee Show, Sarah Chowdhury.
Hi! What a lovely welcome.
Yeah, not bad for a local girl from Poole.
So that was quite a long time ago, working with Prue Leith, Michael Caines and Raymond Blanc. But what an experience to work with people like that, just as I was entering the food industry.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, I mean, so it's only as recent as 2016 you were entering the food industry?
Well, I was actually born in the Indian catering industry. I was born into the, you know, my parents had an Indian restaurant and I used to help them in the restaurant. But I used to deal mainly with people, not really in the kitchen. So I would be like front of house and I would be managing the restaurant. It's only much later, after I got married and had kids and thought I wanted to go back into doing something for myself, that I thought, you know, what would work really well for me right now, and it was food, because it's kind of like the, you know, it's something that was so important that we sort of bring our children up eating the right kind of food, and it's such an everyday routine for everybody to be eating, so I couldn't think of a better thing to go into. So that was kind of how it started, and it was, I just thought I'd sort of see what the water was like. And I started by doing a YouTube video, which, you know, which got quite a lot of views. And then in a moment of feeling cocky, I just sent it to Channel 4 and they liked it. And then the next thing, I was in this program. But I'll be honest, I didn't do very well in the program. It was my first ever, you know, sort of attempt at getting involved in.
Sorry, can I just jump in here? So you just started a YouTube channel. Your feelings like, oh, sorry, I'll just send it off to Channel 4. And like the next thing, they're inviting you to come on the show. That must have been quite a scary moment.
Well, I actually hadn't started my YouTube channel at that point. I just did a YouTube video, and it was for a friend of mine who's also local in Poole. So, you know, it was a friend who was doing lots of vlogging at the time. So she asked me if I would do an Indian cooking video for her channel, which was for parents. It's called Hey Mummy. And I did this video for them. And she said to me, well, you're getting so many views on this. You should be thinking about what you're going to do with this. So I thought, okay. And I think it kind of boosted my confidence a bit. Mm-hmm. And I just sent it I saw something Facebook or somewhere about Channel 4, and I thought, I'm just going to do it. You know, what's the worst that can happen? And I did it, but only because I didn't think anything would come of it. And then the next thing I know, I was invited to go and be a part of a show, which they didn't tell me who was in it or what the show was about. they just said it was to do with cooking, and I thought, okay, why not? You know, and then I found out I was going to be cooking for these three celebrity chefs, and I thought, oh my God. But I'll be honest with you, that if I was already in the food industry and already cooking, that wouldn't have been a good outcome for me. But because I was only just starting in the industry, I think it helped me. It gave me a really big boost. It kind of opened a lot of doors for me, and it also built my confidence because I had not worked before. I hadn't worked before. I hadn't worked with, forget about working with TV and media, but actually being with these celebrities. It really gave me a boost of confidence, and it made me feel like I just wanted to continue doing it. And then I just used that as an almost springboard to progress myself further over the past few years.
It's something you said there really kind of struck a chord with me. It's when you said, why not? I think that is actually probably the key to why a lot of people end up doing something with this passion of theirs. Obviously, you've got to have a talent there, but it's just kind of like just that ability to go, why not? Let's try it. Let's give it a go. And then just roll with it and learn from experiences.
Well, what you've just said about what some people have a talent. I think, you know, with cooking, I always find it a very strange thing where sometimes people, you know, it's like it's because it's dependent on individual's flavour, or their taste. So, for example, what I always find it strange in competitions, like if I'm asked to judge a competition, I think for me the worst thing that I can ever do is to judge food. And I don't like being judged on food either, because just because one person likes it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best in the world. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Personally, for me, I always think my mum's the best cook in the world. But then that's because I like her food. But doesn't necessarily mean that everybody feels the same way. But it's very similar with other things, like with books, for example. If somebody reads a book, one person will like it, another person doesn't. It just depends on individual's taste. So, you know, I always find that the strangest thing.
So what would you judge a sort of cooking competition on?
I would say it's, first of all, I think there has to be some element of confidence when you're cooking. Like, I was told when I was taking part in that competition that, you know, it was practice makes perfect. And there were people, you know, in this competition that we did with, you know, those celebrity chefs, there was like, what happened was we were told that we had to create all these different menus and they were going to select one of the menus. And I had given five dishes of what I wanted to cook, what I felt I was very confident in, that I knew I could make this taste nice. I knew everybody would enjoy it, or at least, you know, I enjoyed it that much that I believe that everybody who eats this would like this. But of course, they decide on the dish that you're going to make. So I had to basically give them six menu ideas. And then they went for the one that I really, I went all out and thought, oh, I could do this, but I've never done it before. And I don't know what it's going to taste like. And that was the truth. And that was the one that they chose. Because it sounded good. It sounded something like what you would, you know, get in some sort of five-star restaurant, but it was really not something that we eat every day. So for me, I think, you know, what makes something a really good dish is something that you're confident in making, that you know you've done it, you know you could do it with your eyes closed, kind of thing. The second thing is, when people have that much expertise with making it, they know it tastes nice. And I always think that makes a huge difference. And I would say, thirdly, is the way that you're feeling on that day. I think that is one of the most important things. And I think people forget that. But when they go out to eat at a restaurant, for example, and you order a dish, and you just think, well, you know, we put our order out there, they go away and they cook it and they bring it back. You could go to the same restaurant day in, day out, and eat the same thing. I think people sometimes forget that there is somebody behind the wall that is cooking, that is human, that has feelings and emotions. If they're having a bad day, you're going to know about it in one way or another. And I always think that, you know, when people are at their best, you know, and they're happy with their job. They feel like they're being treated well. I think all of that has a huge impact on the way the food is going to taste. And I think even if we're cooking at home for our children, you know, people, you know, there are so many men and women out there who are so busy all the time. They're always working and they go home and they just want to eat and we can't always afford to, you know, order a delivery or whatever. And so, you know, you just want to go and knock something up in the kitchen to make it quick, simple, easy and delicious. And it depends a lot on the mood that the people are in who are making it. So if they've had a really hard day, they've had a horrible day, but they come back, you will find that it's difficult for them to put the love into the food. Whereas if they're having a very special occasion, it's very romantic, or, you know, or they're just having a lovely day, there's a lot more love that goes into the food that I think will make the world of difference to the way that tastes. They'll take more time with it. They'll be more passionate about cooking. And it all comes out and you all find it in the flavour.
That's really interesting. And do you find also that that you're kind of... I love the idea of kind of cooking as an art form and kind of creativity in it. Are you someone who kind of measures everything and kind of has everything precise, or do you use a bit more of a free hand? Yeah. Kind of think, what can I add to this today?
With measuring. Do you know, it's for me, measuring is the worst thing, because this must be an Asian thing. It must be a problem in Asian households. Our parents don't measure anything. So we don't measure anything, because that's how we were taught. So we do everything by sight. So I will know by looking, you know, at the spoon, how much I need. And to be honest, I get it right most of the time. But that comes with practice. If I'm doing a recipe that I don't, you know, maybe it's not one that I've cooked before, and I'm following a recipe that has been written down, I always think it's somebody has to have had so much expertise to write this down with the exact measurements. I never find it tastes as nice as, you know, I like adding my own twist to my food. I always add a little bit extra of certain things. So, you know, if I'm, for example, cooking something that is like king prawn, I really love the king prawn buna, which is like king prawns cooked with onions, tomatoes, peppers, and it's spicy but not hot.
Yeah.
But the spicier that dish is, I find it nicer. So it's quite nice to put a lot more fresh chilies than we normally would, or a little bit more chili powder than you normally would. But it just depends on my feeling on the day. But no, I'm not a person who measures. I'm terrible with measuring. Not even if I'm making, I made sort of a bread, like a roti, which is a thin bread that we put on. It's similar to a pancake, but a bit thicker. And it takes a lot of preparation with that, and the flour, and then all the other stuff that goes in it. And I feel like I've actually hit the nail on the head. I feel like I know exactly what I need to do. The only thing is, if someone said, well, what measurements do you need? I'd be like, well, I'd have to be there with you, I'm afraid, because I haven't measured it out yet. But I know by sight exactly what I need.
I know what you mean. I like, I don't know about an Asian household, but my mum is Irish. And exactly the same thing. Like, she never kind of usually measured a lot of things. And she, every time she cooked the dish, it was slightly different. And I kind of very much the same thing. I actually sort of switched to a vegan diet a few years ago. And I just love the creativity. Like, you know, what veg have we got? What veg is at the shop? Like, what can I play around with here? And I just love the creativity of that.
Yeah. And with being vegan, because there is a bit of a hype more recently about, you know, veganism, and the types of some of the types of Indian food that we have. And that we make, they're all suitable for vegan people. And, you know, I think there's such a range, and it gives so much flavour to the dish as well. And I think if I was going to be vegan, for me, being somebody who's, you know, being brought up in the, you know, in the Indian food culture, being vegan is an option for me. It is something that I have thought about, but I haven't gone that way yet, because I don't know. I mean, I could if I wanted to, but I don't want to. So yep. Maybe it's something that's coming soon, because more recently, especially, I have found that I'm not enjoying chicken and meat, lamb, as much as I used to. So I'm starting to wonder, is that like a sort of transition that I'm going through at the moment? I would much rather have, you know, vegetables. Yesterday I was, my mum, you know, me and my mum were having a chat about what we were going to eat. We always have this discussion. So my mum lives in Bridport and I live in Bournemouth. Yeah.
So my cousins are from Bridport, sorry, that's why.
So they've got a restaurant in Bridport. So they've got the Taj Mahal restaurant in Bridport.
Right.
And that was where I grew up and that was the restaurant that I used to run. So there is a woman that cooks there, and you know, an Asian woman in the kitchen, which is very unusual. And it was because of that that, you know, we were able to also become sort of disruptors in the Indian food industry, because it's an area that's lacking, where there are no, you know, there are just such a lack of Asian women in the Indian food industry. But sort of going back to what we were talking about with the food and cooking, my mum has a vegetarian day, certain days of the week. And so, you know, we were just talking about what we were cooking. I ended up, because I was listening to her so much, I ended up cooking spinach and then cooking lentils as well. And that was enough for me with some rice. It's a staple diet in India as well, but really delicious, quite kind of wholesome and nutritious as well.
That sounds lovely. And, you know, by the way, if you do switch vegan, I'm going to claim it was me all along, because, you know, we've got a quota of converting people, obviously.
Oh, that's lovely. I will say, yeah, I'm vegan, because I was that happened and now I'm vegan.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Everyone thinks that we've got a quota to try and convert people, so I may as well play into it.
Exactly.
And you were talking about kind of being an Asian woman in business and in kind of the Indian food world. Kind of what extra challenges has that thrown your way? And is there still as big a stigma? Is it getting any better?
Okay, so I was doing so many things with Indian food and was actually, even Forbes recognised me as a disruptor in the Indian food industry, because I was highlighting the fact that I didn't think there were enough opportunities for women. I think there's basically one in five chefs are women generally, and that's not even in the Indian food industry. So you can imagine it's much, much less. So one in five is already, there's already a lack of women anyway, in any to do with food. So because with our culture, I would say the expectation, which is quite a traditional one, is that women are expected to know how to cook, and they are normally the ones who are cooking in the household. So because of that, I always sort of think, then why is it that in the restaurants it's more of the men that are doing that?
Yeah.
And why are the women at home? Because if the women's food is good enough for the owners of the restaurants, for example, then why are they not in the restaurants? So that kind of became a big question for me, and that was the story that reached Forbes. And the reason it reached Forbes was because it was a disruptive story, because I was basically saying, why do we need to? We were talking about immigration rules in the UK and the lack of staff. Qualified staff that we have due to immigration rules. So one of the things that I sort of said was, why do we need people to come over from another country to cook when we have perfectly fantastic chefs here that are sitting, you know, in the homes and providing the food for those husbands? Why are they not in the kitchen then? Because I know that they're all, you know, fantastic cooks. And so basically what that meant was, it kind of upset a few people, like, you know, as you do. But it also, it highlighted an area that I think is quite important to look at, because of the, like I say, it's, you know, quite a backward mentality. It's quite, you know, we're in 2021 now, and it's that I think that sometimes the traditions and the cultures can just drag on a bit, just carry on going on. But it's like, it seems to be mixed messages where, like, women are expected to, Asian women are expected to have this certain sort of qualification of cooking when you get married. Like, do you know how to cook? It was one of the questions that normally gets asked. Now, this isn't with everybody, so I hope anyone who's listening doesn't get offended by that. But it is, you know, this is a fact. These are some of the things that are, you know, with some with some families that they would expect the woman would know how to cook.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so if they do know how to cook, then, you know, and if they're, and they're brilliant at what they do, rather than being at home while we were, while the country was kind of, especially the food industry, was saying that we needed to change immigration rules and we needed to bring people over from Bangladesh or from India to come and cook. It was, for me, I was like, why? Get your wives to come and help. We don't need people from abroad because these women can work perfectly well. Husband and wife teams can be fantastic teams. It can help the family to grow. It can help, you know, economy. It helps in so many ways. It teaches the children different values. It's, you know, it's just different ways of looking at things, really.
It's really interesting you should say that, because I found the most interesting thing in the whole like Brexit debate, which obviously immigration came at the forefront of that, was that even though I'm kind of pro-Europe myself, like I think the best arguments my friends were making for Brexit weren't the ones being being put out there by the government. They were mostly stirring up kind of just kind of a lot of stuff with different countries and people's feelings towards different countries. Let's just put it that way.
Which was,
and
it's really which is nothing to do with the development of our country or of Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of really interesting because that argument, the what you're saying about, you know, getting Asian women cooking and getting them into business, that kind of would have been a fascinating thing to look at in the whole Brexit debate. And it just didn't enter into it, you know, or just immigration in general, I should say.
Well, it doesn't, but because of the, you know, because of the article that was in Forbes, they called it the Curry Queen Rules. It was highlighting that issue. It was also highlighting other things, an award ceremony, for example, you know, the Curry Awards, Chef, and all of these different, you know, Indian food awards. You'll find that every single person that goes up and wins awards will be a male. Right. Yeah. And one of the issues that I encountered was that I was asked, as I was starting to progress in my own career, I was asked by you know, different people who run the awards to enter their awards, where they personally said, you know, we've seen you're making a huge impact. We'd love to have you at our awards. Please, can you fill out an application form? We, you know, I mean, when the owner of or the person, the founder of the awards phones you personally and tells you that, you know, put yourself in for my award, it's quite a big thing. But then when I look at the categories, what happened with me was I was looking at these categories and it was like chef of the year, chef of the this, chef of the that. And I thought, well, I don't fit in. I don't feel that I was chef of the year. I didn't feel that I was, you know, a restaurant of the year because I don't have a restaurant, or takeaway of the year. And then they had Curry King. And then where they had the Curry King, I was like, well, they don't have a Curry Queen, right? So that was that for me, being the kind of, you know, she won't shut her mouth up kind of person. I was just a bit like, I don't think you're ready for me to enter your awards. And he was like, what do you mean you're not ready? And I was like, well, you know, you're just not ready. And I kind of left it at that. A few days later, I got another call from him again. What do you mean? I don't understand. There are so many categories offered, but I don't fit into any of these categories. And, you know, I've, in the past sort of 3-4 years, I won 7 awards. I won 39 accolades. And, you know, with that, I mean, the way that I do that and the way that I try to push myself to progress in that way with winning awards and things like that is because you have to make sure that you put yourself in the right category. You have to make sure that you're applying for the right award. It's no use just applying for anything. You know, you have to fit the criteria. So I said, I don't feel that I fit this criteria, and I don't think you're ready for women yet. And he was really shocked. And I said, and he said, what makes you say that? And I said, well, you've got a Curry King, but you don't have a Curry Queen. So once you put a Curry Queen on there, or you initiate some sort of women figure in your awards, I'd be happy to enter. And I left it at that. But the thing was, where you talk about challenges, is actually he didn't introduce, there was never a category like that. And they didn't introduce one either, even though I did win an award with that company, but not for Curry Queen. They didn't introduce one. So instead, what they did was they took the Curry King off which I thought, at least I made some sort of impact, do you know what I mean? But it was a shame. It was a shame that you're happy to have a curry king but not a curry queen. And I think that, in my opinion, is a challenge, because it's not a personal challenge to me, but it's a challenge to the entire female race. If yeah. we've got to go against people like this who want us to go in and enter their awards, because we will somewhat promote their award. We will, if when you people put themselves in for awards, it's a two-way thing. So, you know, if you're just sitting there and going, oh, I'm going to win an award, and you win it and you don't do anything with it, that's your fault. But if you take that award and if you say, well, I'm going to really blast this and let everybody know about this, and I'm going to promote the company, I'm going to promote what they're doing, I'm proud to have been a winner with them, and I'm going to help them because they helped me, right? So yeah. if you turn around and do that, then people do want you in their awards, because they know that you're also promoting them, and they need that. Everybody needs that in any business. And so I felt that because I felt that I was doing that and trying to promote other people and other businesses, I felt that people did want me in their awards, and they were trying to get me in. But then I felt that it was almost a sort of one-way sort of stream. Well, she will be promoting us as well. But at the same time, I think for me, I was highlighting challenges that I think is not necessarily personal to me myself, because I did win an award. But I felt like, you know, this is the issue. If you're prepared to have, you know, this for a male, then why not for a female?
Also, I kind of love their solution was, well, we could recognise women, or we could just pull the award. Let's pull the award, you know. That's crazy.
let's pull it. Or, you know, and I don't know if they did it, and I don't know if they did it just for that year or if they did it again after. I continue to, with any of the people that I've won an award with in the past, I continue to promote them as well. It's not like, oh, I've won it 1 year and that's it, I won't promote it anymore. I continue to promote it because I know that every time you win something like this, it opens doors for you, it opens other opportunities for you, and it helps you to get out there, but it also helps the other people who are in there. There are other people who feel the same way as we all do. We all go through that kind of imposter syndrome. I mean, in 2016, when I started, nobody knew anything about, you know, who is this person coming out and sort of, you know, suddenly on TV. There was no build up to it. It wasn't like I had started and I was in a restaurant. It was a kind of all of a sudden sort of thing. And it was like a big bang for me. It kind of all started with a big bang and like, woo, all of this stuff happening. And then I didn't want to let it go, because when you've been at home for years, you've been looking after children for years, it was boring. You know, don't get me wrong, I love my children, I give my life up for my children. But once they start going to school and you're at home every day, it becomes tedious. You're never-ending cleaning. I think other women can probably resonate with what I'm saying, especially if they're in a situation where the children have started to go to school. You hang around with the same sort of people every day. You're having the same conversations. It becomes depressing. Your mind starts clicking onto things that are just so irrelevant and unimportant in your life. Carry on.
No, I was just going to say, and just to sort of like round up this chat, because I know you've got a busy day ahead of you. Just the thing which I find kind of really interesting in what you're saying and in general is that it seems like if someone is just another person of the same type who usually wins the award, shall we say, like they seem very much about kind of keep the status quo and not kind of opening doors necessarily for the next person. Whereas if someone wins an award or if someone kind of comes to recognition and they're the first kind of like woman, the first Asian person, the first whatever, you know, it seems to be about opening more doors for more people. What was your advice to people to try and kind of inspire the next and to inspire people?
I would say there are so many people out there doing amazing things. Number one is the confidence that they have in themselves. We genuinely feel as though, and that's not necessarily just women, but even, you know, for men who have maybe left their job in a corporate world or something like that, especially more recently with the COVID stuff that's happened, so many people have been made redundant, so many things have happened where people didn't really see that coming. And all of a sudden, they're just left with, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And they've normally got a fantastic idea that they've always had. but now it's given them the opportunity to sort of work on it. And then what happens is they're developing their idea, developing their product or whatever it might be, their service or whatever, and they want to sort of go out to market with it. But the biggest issue that they encounter is that they don't think that anybody's going to like their stuff. They don't, they suddenly get this, while they're creating it and they're working on it and they're passionate about it, it's all they think, oh, people are going to love this, you know, and I can't wait to make it. And if they didn't think that people would love it, they wouldn't be doing it in the first place. It's because something has sparked an interest in it. And so they create this thing, and then they suddenly get these like cold feet just as they're about to go to market with it. And they think, oh my God, like no one's going to like this. What am I doing? And it's like a serious case of imposter syndrome, where they feel like even when they get any kind of recognition, if somebody says, oh, that's nice, they think, oh, they're just saying it. Or, oh my God, they might realize that I'm a fraud. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not actually the case. The case is their product is good, what they're doing is good, and they love it enough to have gone through the, through the whole thing of making it and creating it. But it's just one of those things that people seem to go through. And I would say that, you know, to sort of, you have to go past that bit. You have to go past the bit of thinking, I know there are people who have actually created things and not even put it out there because they thought, oh God, no one's going to like it. At the last minute. And they had worked themselves up to this place where they could do it, and then they dropped out at the last second. And I think you just have to go with it, and you just have to think, you know what? What is the worst that's going to happen? People won't like it. And so what? You like it. And you've got no proof of that unless you go out and you try it. So my thing to get people to go out and to do it is to really try to work on that feeling, which is your own confidence building. And I would say things like reading, gratitude, you know, journaling, that kind of thing. I think all of that really helps.
That's wonderful. And for people who want to learn more, where can they find you online?
My Instagram, I am Sarah Chowdhury. So it's not Sarah Ali Chowdhury anymore. It's Sarah Chowdhury. I am Sarah Chowdhury on Instagram. I've also got a Facebook page, which is just my name, Sarah Chowdhury. What else am I on? Oh, yeah, Twitter, Sarah Curry Queen.
Wonderful. Thank you much, very much, Sarah. And what an inspiring and wonderful story. Have you got a tune you'd like us to play to go out of this interview?
I think I'd like Bobby Brown's Two Can Play That Game.
Okay, here's Two Can Play That Game by Bobby Brown going out to Sarah the Curry Queen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Paul Gross, and you're listening to The Bear. Thank you kindly.
That was I Don't Believe in Love by Queensryche, and that's from way back in the 90s, I think that one is. A bit of classic rock for you there, slash what passed for metal back in the 90s. So I hope you enjoyed that. Now, I would like to apologise like if I was a bit thrown earlier on in the show, but last minute, unfortunately, Nicola had to drop out from doing the show tonight. She had a bit of a bad head. So I was just last minute scrambling to get some replacements. So in a little bit, we are going to be talking about WandaVision, but instead I'm going to be joined by my friends James King and Paul G. James King, of course, from the Retrek podcast, he's been on the show before, and Paul G, who has equally been on the show before from Who News. So we'd like to thank them for stepping in very last minute. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go through a few of the answers from the big question of the week, then we're going to play a tune, then we're going to be in on that, so we're all caught up. And of course, I would like to thank the Curry Queen herself, Sarah Chowdhury, for joining us tonight. So, the question of the week, of course, was surrounding WandaVision. So that programme is where people have been sucked into a sitcom world of Wanda's making. But what TV show would you like to be stuck in, and who with? and why? So, first of all, Ben Gumery's put Quantum Leap for sure. No reason, nothing else given, just Quantum Leap. And then Gemma's put, damn it, Ben, that was going to be mine. Could I be in there with you? So that answers that one. That's who you're going to get stuck with, Ben. If you don't give us, you're just going to get assigned someone. So you're in there with Gemma there. Gemma, of course, from the Talking Codswallop podcast, which is up after this show. We've got Kate Millard-Starkey has put, Bewitched as to be with who? A young Cary Grant would be nice. Nice, I like it. And she's put, why? I'm a sucker for the 50s and 60s. All my clothes are from those eras. My kitchen is a mid-century modern design. But what appeals along with that is that Samantha isn't the usual housewife of the era. Yes, she appears to be sweet, a sweet little woman, but she's different to the ones we've seen in other comedies of the time. She not only has magical powers, but she has gumption too, and just the right amount of wickedness and mischief, which we always like. It's the kookiness of it that would be ace, and to be able to twitch my nose and dinner appear on the table and the dish to be washed and laundry folded. Oh. Also, all the fun I would have with those powers and people. I like it. So our next one comes from Paul G himself, who's going to be joining us shortly. He's put Alf because those sandwiches needed mayo, and he's put a picture of one of Alf's famous cat sandwiches, which he used to make. Stacey Taylor's put, so I don't think it's like the best show ever or anything, but me, the hubby, and my closest buds in Friends would be great. Anything fairly low stakes, people rarely get hurt or sick, and I get to fart about in coffee shops most of the time. Sounds great to me. Oh, what a great answer. Paul Wright's put Baywatch, need I say more? And I'm just going to assume, because he hasn't put who he's going to go with, he's going to go with me. So I'll join you on Baywatch with those bouncing beauties. And of course, the Hoff. William Lowe's put, I think one of the best TV series, but cut short of one series, is Space Above and Beyond. Just with myself, because no one else would understand it. Fair enough. Catherine Teresa Taberna has put EastEnders with my dog Chewy, who would definitely cheer them all up, which, of course, in EastEnders, they need it. Look, we've got a few others, which I will hopefully bring in before the end of the show. But let's go to one more track before we talk WandaVision. So this is WandaVision by Queen. See, WandaVision, WandaVision. You see what I did there. That was One Vision by Queen. And again, of course, I'm going to play One Vision going into WandaVision. Like, it's just too easy a pun not to play. I am now joined by two gents who have what I always look for in guests on the Dr. Squee Show. Last minute availability when other people cancel. Please welcome to the Dr. Squee Show, Paul G from Who News.
Good evening.
And James King from Retrek.
Hello.
How are you guys tonight? How are you, James?
Yeah, not too bad at all. I was watching some Netflix true crime documentary, so you've spared me from that.
And Mr. G, how are you?
Yeah, all good. You timed it perfectly. I just finished watching RuPaul's Drag Race. So,
nice. Yeah. So you'll be all revved up for this then.
Absolutely. Yeah. Excuse the language.
It does some funny things to Paul G. That's all I'm going to say. So, guys, WandaVision, like, it's about to come to a close after it's pretty much, as far as we can tell, one-and-done series. It has been such an amazing departure for Marvel, who obviously usually rule the cinema and all things cinematic, and it seems to be that they've made this just in the perfect time, because when they would have been making this would have been before all the lockdown and anything to do with Corona would have been in the news, because this has been in the works for quite a while. So, first of all, just what wonderful timing by Marvel to have this one in the chamber, eh?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's something you desperately needed during these times, and it's something that's completely left field as far as Marvel's concerned. So.
Yeah, and just generally, it's just such an out there concept. So let's just dive into it. So The thing which was just, which has caused a lot of debate is those first two episodes. So as this starts off, we don't know what's happening. We don't know how they're in this kind of like weird sitcom world. All we know is like Wanda and the Vision seem to be living this life. We pretty soon work out that Wanda has more knowledge than the Vision on what's going on. But they're just living this sitcom life. And there's been a lot of debate whether or not these kind of first two episodes were good. Like, because did it fall too much into just being a direct two sitcoms as opposed to being what it would then turn into? What were your first thoughts, James?
I can see both sides of the argument on this. And it's one of those things where people have talked about, you know, it's weekly and a lot of people have kind of kicked off and said they should have just dropped it all at once. And I think had they dropped it all at once, I think these first few episodes would have been much better received because they would have seen where it's going. I think the fact that they did play it as though it were this sitcom thing required a greater knowledge of the comics and the backstories than probably the average viewer has. Because, you know, I'm watching it and I'm like, well, obviously this is something Wanda's done because her powers would allow her to do something like this, you know, like the House of M storyline and all that business. So I knew it wasn't what it appeared to be. So I was ready for the other shoe to drop, whereas I think it threw quite a few people who didn't expect that. And yeah, I thought they were good, and I think they will benefit greatly from a rewatch. But I can see why people may have lost patience in the early days, because it was two dropped at once, and then there was a third one that was pretty much that before we got that episode four that turned it all around. So
yeah
I can sort of see it.
I mean, that to begin with, I was thinking, it's like, look, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the idea of having just two straight up kind of sitcoms with just small flashes of, you know, what was to come. But I was thinking, it's like, oh, geez, they really haven't given us much to hang our jackets on. They haven't really given us what was going to sort of like happen in the episodes to come. But the further in we go, the more I realize that these first two episodes show you that this is Wanda's safe space. The more signs you have of anything else going on, the more it breaks the fourth wall, ironically, that this is Wanda's world. You know, like now we're seeing the kind of payoff of everything crumbling around her and reality crashing in. I think that's where you hit the pay dirt of those first two episodes. And just the kind of like the sheer form of the episode. So like there were so many sitcoms you could see in them straight away. Now, I wasn't that familiar with the Dick Van Dyke Show because I don't think it ever really came over here. But you generally got everything about the setup of kind of living in those sitcom worlds and obviously the nods to Bewitched and so many other shows. Paul, what did you think of the first couple of episodes?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of came at this, I mean, quite fresh sort of thing, because I've got no background on sort of, you know, the comics and sort of the origin stories and anything like that. So this was coming at this with like completely new eyes. And certainly for the first two episodes, I did sort of sit there and think, what the hell's going on? But there was enough in those first two episodes, and especially there was, I think each one of them had sort of like a particularly dark or moment sort of thing, or a little bit of moment sort of like took you out of the sitcom part of it, and you sort of thought, what's going on? So I'd already started to form my own sort of theories, which were completely wrong sort of things. I thought it was some sort of like some digitized space that the Wanda Vision, and you know, and Wanda might not even be there was my initial thoughts on it. You know, it was just something that was fabricated in a digital world for Vision. But I just wasn't sure. And so, but it gave me enough to sort of want to carry on viewing and sort of thinking, what is going on? But it did take until that, really that sort of fourth episode. But I sort of thought, right, okay, I'm starting to get a little bit more of a handle on this. But by then, I was already hooked. I was already engaged just purely because there was some very, what I thought, quite dark elements to it that just sort of flashed up. And then sort of Wanda almost did like a little reset and sort of rewound the timeline and what have you, and then carried on. Sort of thing. And that was those bits that thought, hang on, there's a bit more to this than meets the
eyes. Yeah, I think there was definitely a degree of you had to know what Marvel is and had to have that built trust from Marvel. Because if this was just two episodes which kind of just appeared to be a sitcom and I didn't have any other knowledge of these characters or of this world, I definitely wouldn't have stuck with it. But knowing that, it kind of did give me a safety that, look, they're doing this right now, but they're leaving something. There will definitely be something else later. And I think they have earned that over, what is it, 20, 21 movies, however many it is. I also love the fact that something which people mentioned online was, I heard a few places saying that Paul Bettany was doing a bit of a Rick Mayall in a few episodes. Did you guys pick up on that at all?
No, I can't say I did.
I was just a few gurns and things he did to the camera. And I was thinking, like, because people were saying about this, I was going, yeah, but if you think about it, when he was growing up, he probably was watching the likes of The Young Ones and those earlier programs with Rick Mayall, who was a hero to so many of us, in it. So I kind of like the idea that he might have picked that up. I'd love to ask him.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't make the Rick Mayall connection specifically, but I do think what they've both been, or both the principal actors have been really good at, is adapting to that form. And each episode, when it's moved through the decades, they've tempered their performance with that, and they are believable performing as though they were actors from that era, you know. So it's both of them have been incredibly impressive in what they're doing with the characters in it. So
yeah, I agree. I think, like, Elizabeth Olsen, I think, has really shone throughout the series, and sort of the, as you say, the range of acting and how she switches from one character to another has been incredibly good. So
yeah, you've got to hand it to her, because I feel like now it's actually the first time when we're really, she's given centre stage. Yeah, she had her moments in Age of Ultron and the other movies, but I don't think she's ever been given this kind of much to carry, and she's clearly very capable and fantastic in this show.
Not in Marvel, but, like, I first saw Elizabeth Olsen in, I think it's called Martha, Marcy May, Marlene, where she plays someone who basically gets ends up more or less being kidnapped by a cult. And I think that was her first big acting role, and she was fantastic in that. So she can definitely carry material on her shoulders, but yeah, she's not done that, because all the films she's been in to this point have been big ensemble pieces. So.
And let's face it, even with ensemble pieces, still, I think Marvel is, let's just say, getting better at having stronger female characters be front and centre. I think they've got it kind of like licked now, but maybe in the earlier days it was a bit sort of more male-centric. The likes of, the Black Widow kind of just being sort of introduced in other movies as opposed to her own.
Yeah, Scarlett Johansson, yeah.
Yeah, I think they've done a better job with it now, but it took them a little while to cotton on that maybe these women folk might be able to do something here.
But, yeah, I think they are building to something with the character of Wanda. Like, she's, I think she's supposed to be in the next Doctor Strange film, and I would expect that the episode that will go out tomorrow will do something to set that up. But again, sort of in the comics, she is portrayed as one of the most powerful beings in the Marvel Universe, or that specific Marvel Universe. And I think they are building towards that now. So that'll certainly be interesting to see where they go with her after this.
Getting back to the kind of ongoing WandaVision, so like in episode 3, that's when you went into colour and you had the storyline with her miraculous pregnancy, and that's where you start to get the kind of first flashes of her really just resetting time. I don't know if they did it in the last black and white one, but certainly in the third one, like, there's a couple of times where she just resets things, and it's kind of really quite chilling, because as soon as something doesn't go away, it's just like, reset, everyone just dance to my tune.
So I think, and also came across sometimes as almost like another sort of aspect of her psyche that was coming through and doing that. And so it was almost, you know, so there was almost like two parts of her that was battling, you know, was sort of in the same being. So you've got the one who's actually living the TV fantasy, and is playing the housewife or whatever it happens to be. And then you get this other sort of like aspect of her personality which seems to step outside, take control, does what it needs to do, and then dips back into the character again.
Yeah,
it's like what she's done with her vocal inflictions. Like, I know they've made jokes about her accent, which disappeared in between movies, and you know, they have sort of called that to attention. But there was a bit, and I think it may have been episode 3, where she switched the accent on, and all of a sudden you were aware that, oh, actually, no, she is the one that we know, and she is aware of what's going on, and it was just changing the way she delivered it, the way she used her voice, that made you realise that the character sort of spun on a dime. And on what you were saying about the where she would reset things, I think this is something where if you look back at those first couple of episodes, I'm willing to bet there's bits in there where it's done through editing that when you rewatch it, you'll go, oh, I bet she did a reset there. Because there was a hint of that once they established what was going on and they sort of did a flashback to one of the black and white bits. So I bet there's lots of little Easter eggs like that. So I'm waiting until it's finished before I rewatch the whole thing. But
oh, yeah, no doubt. I think this is very cleverly written. And again, this is the thing. I'm actually really appreciative that they have done it an episode a week now. Like, to begin with, I was just impatient as hell, because that's what we're trained to be with Marvel and with all binge TV now. But now it's just really become event TV. I haven't felt this about a show for a very long time, that it's like, oh, I can't wait to go back next week. I'm really looking forward to having the week in between to discuss my theories with my mates. And I actually kind of really appreciate they brought that back.
Yeah, I mean, they did it with The Mandalorian as well. And part of this, I think, is because apart from the copious back catalogue that they've got, Disney Plus doesn't have a right lot going on at the moment. And part of that is because they had a lot of things in the works before the pandemic, and so everything's been delayed. So I think part of it is a financial decision that, okay, if we drop all this at once, people are going to get a month, sign up for a month, watch it, and then they're gone. Whereas if we do this over 9 weeks, then, you know, they're going to have to pay for at least 2 months, and maybe they'll stick around. So I think there's an element of that. But I do think you're right that they've succeeded in bringing back this thing of event TV. Everybody's talking about it on the internet, particularly over the last week. Everybody's been talking about that line that Vision had about grief, and, you know, that's just blown up into its own thing. And so, yeah, there is a thing of that. And even when you get these shows that all drop at once, like, you know, there's probably one dropping on Netflix tomorrow, a whole season. But, you know, some people might watch it Friday night, some might watch it Saturday, some might watch it Sunday, some will watch it the following week, some will watch it in a month. And you don't get that instant reaction and that sense of community that we are experiencing with WandaVision. It's been really interesting.
Also, I think you'll talk about that for like maybe a weekend, or it'll be in the conversation for a week. This is spun out. Like, you know, I don't care how cynically they did it to get my subscription. It worked. I didn't give a shit. It was wonderful. This has been marvelous. And unlike like The Mandalorian, a fantastic show, really celebrated by a lot of us. Same with Star Trek Discovery, of course, like we've discussed it on Retrek. Yep. And that's great. But this one is such a mystery show that it's got that drive to discuss theories and ideas. And of course, the same was kind of true of Discovery, because they had some on-running plots. And this series, they kind of took it further into the future. So there was that element, but not to this degree. Like, everyone has been on tenterhooks wanting to know what's happening. And as Paul said, like, there's been so many, like, theories. Everyone's got a theory every week, and we're usually proved wrong. But you just don't care. You get to come up with a new theory. That's the beauty.
That's to the point now where the showrunner has actually been on social media over the last day saying, you all need to temper your expectations. You've all come up with these amazing theories. You will be disappointed.
Yeah, he's just gameless again, though. He's got the goods.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, of course, where it kind of really seems to come into its own is past episode 4. And I think we'll just get more into a general thing here. But it's the whole idea that then we do peer behind the curtain. We do get to see the outside world kind of infringing. We do get to see just like how nuts it is that she's taken over this town. And at least even if we haven't got the bigger picture, we start to get an idea of it. Paul, what were your feelings when you start to see the outside world?
I found that, yeah, that it gave it a context. You could see what was going on. But once again, it wasn't sort of like obvious, you know, there was still lots and lots of mystery, there was still lots of question marks, and each episode sort of just, you know, compounded the number of questions that you had, to be honest, I think. But what it did allow was more characters to come into it, and, you know, and other, you know, other elements and angles to come into the actual show, sort of thing. And the fact that you had the characters that were inside the TV show, so you had the likes of Catherine Hahn and, you know, and sort of other characters and bits and pieces like that. But then you also had people, I mean, in fact, they brought in like Darcy Lewis back from, like, the Thor movies. Yes. I thought that was really good, you know, to see her, you know, basically come up with the same role again, and to see how she's moved on. I thought that was very, very good. And she was a, you know, real highlight, somebody that, you know, I can watch for hours, because once again, I think her performance was very entertaining.
Yes, and you've got Monica Rambeau, who's the daughter of the best friend from Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
So I love the kind of interconnectivity. They are so good at weaving it together. And, like, suddenly we're introduced to S.W.O.R.D., which previously we've only had S.H.I.E.L.D. So now we're S.W.O.R.D.'s, of course, going for threats from outside this world, where S.H.I.E.L.D. is protecting us. I think I've got that right.
No, you're right if you're talking in the comics, but they've changed the acronym for S.W.O.R.D., so it looks like within the MCU now, S.W.O.R.D. is an extension of what they were setting up with the Sokovia Accords, so they basically keep an eye on super persons.
Right.
I can't remember what it stands for. It's like superhuman weapon operating, you know. It's one of them where you start with the word and work backwards to get the acronym. But yeah, so they have slightly changed it compared to what it was in the comics.
Yeah, I think it's in S.H.I.E.L.D. where they say, you know what that means, that someone really wanted our name to be S.H.I.E.L.D. So yeah. It's kind of a bit like that. But I think this just really opens up the mystery. And it's then you start to... I love also the flashes we've had along the way where we start to see some people who seem to be self-aware. So it's like, oh, does Wanda have complete control or not? Or, you know, are these people just playing along because they've got to, or is her control weakening? And then later on, of course, you find out the reason why they know what's going on, because they're being controlled. But I also like it when Paul Bettany starts to suddenly question his world. So he's from a position of not knowing who he is or where he really comes from, but he kind of knows who he is, and he kind of knows that something's not right here. And I just love that uncertainty, because it's like, you know, just... it's the safety of his world crumbling that starts to crumble Wanda's world.
Yeah, and you had that wonderful scene where they were doing sort of the talking head to the camera, like in the style of Modern Family. Yes. And all of a sudden he's like, what am I talking about? Why am I doing? And he gets up and walks out of the frame. I mean, that's just brilliant. He's just taking the meta humour to another level. But yeah, I thought that was fantastic.
And it's really nice, because Paul Bettany is a wonderful kind of both serious and comedic actor. And obviously with Vision, it's mostly been the serious and possibly a bit of comic coming off the back of how serious he is. But it's nice for him to actually be able to play a few silly lines and have a bit more fun in this.
Yeah, the humour from Vision is one of them where he plays it absolutely straight, and that's where the humour comes from. But yeah, he's actually getting to make people laugh on purpose now, you know, so yeah, it's good.
And the Halloween episode, Paul, what do you think of the Pietro reveal of the Pietro, or the equivalent to Pietro from the X-Men universe?
Oh, I did. It was just one of those moments where my jaw just hit the floor. It was just like, what the hell, sort of thing, you know, and that's where, like, the episode ends, and you sort of think... And I think, once again, as you said, it's event TV. You've got a week to think about that, a week to sort of think, how is that possible? How is this coming? Why has he been recast? I just thought it was brilliant. I thought it was so unexpected.
And the thing I'm wondering is, because they've said that he was put there now by, if you haven't already got the fact that we're spoiling things by now, spoiler alert, we later find out, of course, it's Agatha who's caused... It was Agatha all along, if you will. But I'm wondering if they are going to tie it into the multiverse, because it seems like, considering we're going into the multiverse and he's a character from the Fox X-Men movies, which is now owned by Disney, it would seem weird if it doesn't connect back, James?
Yeah, weirdly, I actually expected it to be him when she opened the door. Because Elizabeth Olsen tweeted something about there's going to be such a big cameo next week. And that got me thinking, right, what could they do? And I did expect it because I was thinking, what's the weirdest thing they could do? Now, that one, so when you first saw him, yes, you had all these thoughts like, but he's from the other franchise and what's going on? And that's a different version of a brother, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but at this stage, it looks like they're not actually doing a right lot with that. Agatha's just sort of said, oh, yeah, it's fake Pietro. And so it almost appears like they've conned us a little bit with that, because obviously they knew it would get everyone in a big tiz. And we're all thinking about this multiverse stuff and everything. And if it does just turn out that, oh, yeah, she made a fake version of him and that's all it is, then I feel a bit shortchanged with that. I would love it if they somehow use this to tie the X-Men into it, though I think they will almost certainly recast all of the X-Men. So I don't expect any of them to transition to the MCU fully. So I just don't know. It feels like almost like they baited us with something and then they're not going to pay it off. But as I said, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. It could well turn out that he is the Pietro from the X-Men films. And especially with all the talk of the new Spider-Man film apparently having characters from the Sony Spider-Man films. So I would love it if they did that and acknowledge that there are other Marvel films. And, okay, generally they're not as good as the ones we're getting now, but, you know, at least acknowledge it. So I would like them to do more with him than it appears that they're doing at the moment.
You see, my feeling is that they've kind of set up the fact that, A, with J. Jonah Jameson being played by Simmons in the Spider-Man movies, they've already kind of crossed the Rubicon that they can say, it's like, look, if we want to bring in a character that we like from the other films, we can do it. We will just straight up do that. So I think they have at least got the scope to pick and choose characters. So I think you're right that probably they won't cast any X-Men from those movies. But if they're going to go multiverse, they could pepper in some. They could throw some into, like, you know, I'm guessing if they could get Hugh Jackman to guest appear, for instance, in a multiverse movie, they're going to grab that with both adamantium claws.
Hugh Jackman was emphatic when he did Logan that it would be absolutely the last time he would play Wolverine unless he could be in an Avengers film. So
exactly,
we'll just leave that there and see what happens.
So I think that it would be a shame and very unlike Marvel to bait us with such a big carrot and then give us the stick. It's just not like Marvel. Like, they either give us what we expect or something better. So
yeah.
I think to have Pietro, you know, that cameo just be that would seem very unsatisfying. What's your thoughts, Paul?
I'd quite happily just leave it as a cameo. I just think it'd be a nice nod to the other movies. And I think there's almost like a humor element of, you wouldn't expect him, or unless you're James, sort of thing, you wouldn't expect it to be, you know, to have that crossover. But I think you leave it there, sort of thing. You just have it. He comes, he does a couple of episodes, but that's it. But I don't think that necessarily then sort of follows on into a new sort of like multi-universe characters and the blending of it. I think, as James said, if they're going to do that, they're going to do that fresh and new with a younger cast that they can then get a number of movies out in a franchise to do. I think you'll get cameos from the old, X-Men movies and coming in, and those will be those things that you will see and sort of think, yeah, brilliant. Oh, isn't it great to see blah, blah? Or did you notice, you know, this particular character pop up something? But I don't think they'll have a main role. So I just think 2 years of role past.
No, I agree, but not the main roles. But he's already there now. He's already there. Come on, it would just be a crime not to whack him into the multiverse.
I think as a plot function, what he could do is introduce the idea of mutants into the MCU, because we've never really touched on that. And we've started doing that with last week's WandaVision, because as far as we knew up until this point, Wanda and Pietro got their powers from Hydra and Loki's spear and blah, blah, blah. Whereas in the comics, they were mutants. And I think the fact that they've now shown that Wanda had her powers prior to that, you could have something with Pietro or fake Pietro, whatever he's called, talking to her and going, oh, well, in my universe, I'm a mutant and there's these things called mutants. And then that lights a little spark that, oh, and then that begins to set you up for when we discover that there actually have been mutants in the Marvel Universe and we've just not identified them as such. And, you know, we go from there and it leads to an X-Men film, because there is nothing more certain that there will be an X-Men film in the MCU, because X-Men, I believe I'm right in saying, is the biggest selling comic book for Marvel. You know, it outsells Avengers, it outsells any solo title. So it's going to happen. It's just when and how.
Oh, and if they don't do it now, come on. They've got everything set up for it. Why not now? Like, that would be just crazy not to. And for me also, there's the whole thing of, you mentioned the House of M comics before. And a lot of people have suggested, including Kevin Smith, that maybe in the comics where in the House of M storyline, at the end of it, I believe it is the Scarlet Witch who says, too many mutants, and then half of them get wiped out. Or one of the characters certainly says that.
She says no more mutants, which creates the House of M universe, which is the Marvel universe, but with no mutants in it.
There you go. So some people have suggested maybe at the end of this one, maybe there's someone saying, more mutants, and we get the creation of mutants in the Marvel universe.
Pietro could be what gives her the idea to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all kind of, again, Marvel are really good. They never set something up that they don't pay off. So if they didn't at least pay this off in some way, I would personally feel a bit kind of disappointed. It would be like a very rare misstep for them, in my opinion. One other thing I want to bring in, I absolutely loved in, you mentioned it before a bit, James, about where they had the Office/Modern Family style of modern sitcom, where they had the kind of like camera on them and talking to the camera. I love the fact that what this really showed me was that throughout it all, whatever sitcom style we've got matches perfectly with the tone of how Wanda's feeling. So you've got the happy-go-lucky earlier sitcoms, which are, you know, light and fluffy and everything's just a wacky misadventure. In the 90s, you've got kind of got the Malcolm in the Middle style. You can break the fourth wall a bit and you can have some things going wrong, so not everything's perfect for the family anymore. And then by this one, where Wanda's in a real funk, she's kind of really depressedly talking to the camera, eating ice cream, you know. It just really fits so perfectly that you've got that stark talking to the camera style, no laughter track, and it's all kind of very, very stark when she's going through that rut. I thought that really worked well.
It must have been a joy to write, you know, to be able to switch from genre to genre.
That's why now I don't think it was wrong to do those two straight up sitcom episodes at the beginning, because that represents her safe space. And this kind of quite cold world of sitcom we find ourselves in now, you know, obviously they're funny, but they can be quite uncomfortable as part of the humour. And that's what Wanda's going through. And that perfectly sets us up for Agatha and the big reveal there. I mean, that was just the biggest twist yet. And you also get to bring in another sitcom with a kind of Monsters style theme tune, which I absolutely
loved. Yeah, that's very true. And I read a thing, actually, that the Agatha All Along, which has obviously become a massive sensation, apparently the tune to that has been seeded throughout the show. So apart from it being a catchy tune on its own, the reason you found it so catchy is because you've actually been listening to it for 8 weeks and not realised.
Damn you, Marvel, and getting us hooked on your drugs in this subtle way.
Yeah.
Damn it. They're more insidious than the computer game people.
There's plenty of Marvel computer games, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, but, like, they just get us hooked just from the TV shows. They don't need the computer games to get us addicted.
No, it's true. You don't even need an interactive element.
Yeah, we'll just watch, like, Sheep and get just reprogrammed by Marvel. And a happier world it will be once we are. I don't care. Han, what's her first name? Someone help me?
Catherine
Hahn. how amazing was she as Agatha, though? Because she's played it so straight all the way along, given some wonderful performances, like, you know, subtly saying things like, should we do a retake, looking so scared? And she is just so sexy, vampish in this as Agatha when we get the reveal.
Yeah, she's been really, really good. And to have it, I think actors love it when they get to ham it up. And she's playing into that witchy sort of, it is reminiscent of Bewitched and things like that. So, yeah, you get the sense that she's enjoying it. And also, I imagine as an actor, when you're given this thing of, okay, you've got to be quite unassuming for the first 4 hours of the show or whatever, and your job is to make the audience not suspect that you're the bad guy, it must be gratifying as a performer to go, yep, I tricked him for however many weeks. So, yeah, she's getting a moment and she's enjoying it and running with it. Good on her.
And
I think there's probably a good chance if on a rewatch you will actually see an awful lot of subtle looks and particular lines that have much more meaning and have, you know, now that you've got the reveal and you know how, you know, she's pulling the strings.
Well, you go back to those earlier episodes I was mentioning and you've got them kind of talking by the fence until they come out and they act all innocent when Vision comes over and asks what they're talking about. Yeah. And you suddenly realise that's because of her. It's her setup all the way along. And I absolutely love that. I did think as well, the episode previously on, which was last week's episode, depending on when you're listening to this. So we're on the penultimate episode as we're recording this, if you're listening to a podcast or replay later. But that episode could have been so dry as the kind of recap episode, because basically a lot of the stuff which is in it we already know. And a lot of times when they tell us the backstory on episodes of a TV show, it can feel unsatisfying because we already know the details. But the writing is just so rich and so wonderfully done. And you've got Agatha there kind of spilling more information on who she is and what she's doing there. And then you do get that line, which you mentioned before, James, which was just beautiful. As anyone, I think, who's lost someone can say, just having that line, what is grief but love persevering? And it just stopped me cold, that line. It was just so wonderful. It's just poetry. It's amazing. Paul, thoughts?
Yeah. It was as a sort of, like, as you say, as a backstory episode, I think it did. It was very, very well done. And certainly for somebody like myself, something who doesn't know the, you know, the backstory, certainly like Scarlet Witch or Agatha sort of thing, which, you know, you can go off and you can start to look at, you know, where these characters have appeared before in things like the Fantastic Four. I thought it was a really great episode again. And once again, each week you're getting something different. It's not like the same thing each week. It's so completely different that it keeps it very fresh and very entertaining. And to be honest, I haven't experienced that in a TV series for a long time now.
Yeah, and I also thought it was really interesting, and I won't claim that I vocalised this myself. This was from That Man Beyond with Kevin Smith and Mark Bernard, and they were talking about how that Scarlet Witch was said as if, like, you are to become the Scarlet Witch, like she's something foretold, and it just added that extra gravitas to kind of who her character is. James, what do you think of that kind of, like, the bits with Agatha and the who the Scarlet Witch will become?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so I haven't kept up with Marvel Comics as much in the last few years. I think the idea of the Scarlet Witch meaning something is fairly new. So I don't know where that's going to go. But yeah, like you said, the way it was presented was as though the title of Scarlet Witch itself means something, whereas my understanding previously was that's just what they call Wanda. And they even sort of called that out earlier on in the show where they had them saying, oh, what's Wanda's silly superhero name? Or she hasn't got one. And as a viewer, you're going, oh, she's called the Scarlet Witch, but no, they're saving it for this other thing. So I'm interested to see where that's going to go. So it is a part of the mythology of it that I'm not at all familiar with. Again, I imagine that whatever the Scarlet Witch with a, you know, a capital S, capital W is, I imagine we'll put her on almost level pegging with Doctor Strange in terms of the magical hierarchy in the Marvel Universe, and that will again set up this next film that we're going to see. So I'm really interested to see where that goes. And just on the subject of the having a flashback episode, this is, it's really interesting when you look at it structurally. So we've talked about how this is a departure for Marvel. And yes, it is because it's TV, and also it is because it's long-form storytelling instead of short-form storytelling. But it also is in terms of the structure that you're using. If you look at the majority of the Marvel films, they follow pretty much a three-act structure. And they've done that, and it's been incredibly successful to the tune of uncountable billions of dollars. But what they're doing with this show, they've decided to do it in 9 half-hour or thereabouts episodes. But even within that, you can still do that and follow this familiar, comfortable three-act structure. But they've not. They've gone, right, okay, episode 8 out of 9, we're pretty much going to have a break from the main action. We know that Monica Rambeau's been captured by fake Quicksilver or whatever he's called. And we've got all the stuff going on with Darcy and everyone else outside. But we're just going to pause all of that, and we're going to do this flashback. And yeah, we're going to do this with only one more segment left to run. And that should be a crazy thing to do, and it should kill the momentum of the show. But it hasn't, you know, they've earned it. And it works dramatically. So the things that they're doing in terms of structure are really impressive as well. It's a very, very clever show.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you've just gone up to the boudoir, it's just taking you to the bed, it's kind of like starting to crawl up your body, and then it just walks away for a second. That should be a total turn-off, but they're teasing us good.
And it's something that you couldn't do this in a film if you just stuck all this together as a film. If you're in the cinema and you get to the stage where the big battle's about to go off and all of a sudden we get a half-hour flashback, it just would not work, you know. It'd be kind of like in The Matrix Reloaded, where he talks to Colonel Sanders for 20 minutes and it's incredible. but that ruins the pacing of that film. But, you know, so you can't do this in a film. But Marvel have gone, oh, we've got an opportunity with a TV show. They could have easily gone, we'll just write a film script like we know how to do, and we'll chop it up into 8 bits and we'll put it out. But they've gone, no, we've got this unique opportunity. And, well, it's not unique, there's about 1,000 Marvel shows coming, but they've done something interesting with it. And, yeah, it's definitely, I commend that. I think it's really good.
And, James, I don't know what you're talking about Matrix sequels, because they never got around to making those, and you can't tell me otherwise. I'm just imagining it that way.
Yeah, but that's fine.
But getting back to WandaVision, like, I loved as well the whole idea that, because I was so sure, even when they'd shown Wanda walking away from the body of the Vision, I thought when she'd created this fake universe of sitcoms, I just assumed she had somehow drawn the Vision's body into it. She had just somehow kind of, like, just beamed it there effectively. And then to find out that she's just created him whole cloth from nothing. So you've got this Vision who is just completely the Vision. Everything in the way that he thinks and operates is the Vision, even to the fact that he's operating against her will. That's how much he is the Vision. And then you've got this kind of white the Vision now, which is going to come into events. And we're set up for a Vision on Vision showdown is the only way I can think of this going. And I can only imagine, even though I know Marvel, and I know they will never give me what I think's going to happen. They'll give me something better. I can't see how it's not going to end with Wanda having to make the decision to let go of the Vision, to have to let go of this perfect world of hers. What do you think, guys, think's going to happen next? So, Paul first we'll go with.
To be honest, I'm just waiting for tomorrow. I haven't got a clue where this is necessarily going to go now. I think, obviously, there's this sort of like new white blue Vision that, is it Harwood sort of thing, he's going to inject into the scene. I think, yes, he's going to be the weaponized computer control version of it, which I think there's a chance that Wanda is going to have to destroy. But once again, how that then ties in with Agatha, and whether, you know, she's going to have to step away from this sort of fake reality that she's created. I just don't know how it's going to play out, and to be honest, I don't have any great little thoughts. I'm just waiting for it to drop. and then I will watch, and then I will probably be completely baffled. So
you're usually completely baffled, Paul, so who'll notice the difference?
Well, exactly. There's no change in that sort of situation for me.
So, James, your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, you've got evil white Vision. The thing you would expect is that evil white Vision will fight good multicolored Vision, and good multicolored Vision will win. But I don't think they're going to do that. We've also got this thing of what is the Scarlet Witch to resolve. So if I had to guess, I would guess that Agatha will explain to Wanda what the Scarlet Witch is. Wanda will not want to take on this power. Evil white Vision will go rogue and start killing everybody. Wanda will realize that she will have to embrace this power in order to stop him. And in order to stop him, she will have to kill him. So that will mean killing Vision's physical form again. But because of some weird connection between evil white Vision and normal color Vision, that will also mean that she will have to let this Vision go. So, you know, it's going to be very heartbreaking. She's not going to be a happy bunny by the end of this episode, but I think she will be a supremely powerful, not very happy bunny. And I wouldn't be surprised if Benedict Cumberbatch turns up at the end as Doctor Strange and goes, whoa, you've got way too much powers. You're going to have to come with me so I can keep an eye on you. See you in summer 2022 at your local cinema, assuming it's open by then.
Or survive the pandemic. Guys, just very quickly, we've had the big question of the week this week on the show has been around WandaVision. Given that it centres around people getting sucked into a sitcom world, what show would each of you choose to get sucked into, and who would you take with you? So, Paul, you've already answered this, I think, online, but have you got a second answer other than Alf to put mayo on a cat sandwich, which was a very weird answer?
I think that says it all for me. To be honest, I thought long and hard about that, and I really struggled, sort of thing. But one who I was going to take with me, sort of thing, and what I'd like to appear in. So,
okay, James, what have you got for us?
Well, it's probably quite predictable. I'd go live in the Star Trek universe any day of the week. Usually, I would say that I would take my wife with me. I'm not sure she'd thank me for making a live in the Star Trek universe for the rest of eternity. So, I'd probably take the dog.
You see, because, yeah, your wife would be there. Chloe would be very unpleased with being sucked into that universe. And Elliot would be the other side, cursing you forever for not taking him with you.
Yeah, because it's one of them you can't win. If I take Elliot, my brother, with me, Chloe's not going to be happy that I've not picked her. But then she don't really want the thing. So I wouldn't win either way. Yeah, she wouldn't be happy if I took the dogs either. Yeah, I'll just go on my own. I'll just go into the Star Trek universe on my own.
Well, I mean, seeing as I'm going to get sucked into this universe forever, and thusly no one can come in to kill me, sorry, Nicola, but I'm going in Doctor Who, and I'm taking Karen Gillan with me.
You don't need to take Karen Gillan with you. She's already there if you're going into Doctor Who.
Oh, excellent. Two. I'll take Shakira then. Two
there
for
you
one.
Go.
Oh, God, that's such an old pervert answer. I'm sorry, guys.
At least
guys,
you know what song to play next, anyway.
Well, actually, I've got something lined up. So, guys, thank you very much for joining me. Please check out Online Who News from Mr. Paul G and the Retrek podcast, the fine podcast, which even occasionally features me as well as James and Elliot. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
A pleasure as always.
And now to play us out, because, again, I'm cheesy this way. It's Sound and Vision by David Bowie. Sound and Vision by David Bowie. And we've got a few more answers to the big question of the week. And, of course, I would like to thank my guests there, Paul G from Who News and James King from Retrek. So we've got Brian E. Pierce has put, although I wouldn't mind lying on a deserted island, B. beach in Lost. Everyone there would be running around having all these crises, and I'd be like, it's cool, guys. We probably all died in that plane crash anyway. Let's just work on our tans. She's also put, when I was younger, I would have said Buffy. Kicking ass along with a Slayer and her buds would have been my dream. And I had such a crush from Xander and Spike. I'm old now, though, so I'd be more likely to take Ryan Reynolds with me to Schitt's Creek, Friends, or Frasier. Dan Gross put, due south, of course, dancing with Ray Kowalski, which was the second Ray on that show, if you know that program. Kathleen has put, I want to say Supernatural, but knowing the track record for guest stars on that show, I'd be dead in a week. Lean towards Knight Rider, because who wouldn't want to ride in Knight Industries 2000 car? Of course. Kieran has written, a town called Eureka would be pretty good. Things are generally pretty happy, and it's only strange experiments going haywire. Star Trek, TNG particularly, would be pretty a pretty ideal place to have a happy life. Thank you very much for all your answers to the big question of the week. It's been kind of quite one for the answer this week. So we're going to go for one more track. And even though we're heading towards the end of the show, I want to blow the cobwebs off. So this is Rose of Chiron? Rose of Chiron? You know, I've just realised I've never actually read out the name of this track. So Rose of Chiron, we're going to go with, by Killswitch Engage. Prepare to rock. And that old son of a gun time has beaten us once again. I'd like to thank all my guests this week to Paul G from Who News, to James King from the Retrek podcast for talking to me about WandaVision, and to the Curry Queen, Sarah Chowdhury, for talking to me about her wonderful business. Thank you all for joining us this week. And remember, in a world where you can be anything, please be kind. I'm Dr. Squee, and that was my show.
I'm not trying to win. I'm not doing this because I want to beat someone, because I hate someone, or because I want to blame someone. Not because it's fun. God knows it's not because it's easy. It's not even because it works, because it hardly ever does. I do what I do because it's right, because it's decent, and above all, it's kind. It's just that, just kind. Hey, you know, maybe there's no point in any of this at all, but it's the best I can do. Why not? Just to the end, just be kind.